comp 33511 user experience. And next we're on to the next part of the UX notes, and particularly first up is in real life. So what do we mean? Why is this even here? Well, reality is that up to yet I've described the way that these things should work, the way that user experience should work. It's all clean, it's all clear, it's all delineated, you know what you're doing, everybody's happy, software engineers will be supportive of giving you the information you need to help create user tests, the users are always nice, well ordered, come in when you ask them to, give you the answers that you've for questions you've asked, etc. Everything's great, the software is developed fine and all of the best practice is always coded into it properly, and everybody understands the limitations of things like, for instance, gamification and phonology. They also understand the importance of the dynamics, and they understand the importance of progression. What you've got to realise is that in the real world, this isn't how it happens. In the real world, a lot of the work is it's practical, it's pragmatic, in some cases, dare I say, it's sloppy, it's because you've got time constraints that mean that you've got to get things done. So you should expect imperfection in everything that you're doing. Do not expect that everything is going to go according to plan. Do not expect that there won't be problems, there won't be difficult people, difficult users, difficult pieces of software, budget overruns, resource underruns. These things are all going to be part of what you've got to deal with, especially at the user-facing edge, because there's lots of things to balance. Now, the sets of constraints, and these are commissioning constraints, and these are constraints that I've come up with specifically based on my own experience in these kind of things. And so it's useful to just quickly understand some of them, and also it's important to understand that there's kind of an overlap between some of them as well, but I thought it was useful to delineate each one so you could see in more detail what that meant. So, for instance, the just-in-time constraint is related to the too-little-time constraint. This means really that you've been given a plan, you've been given deadlines whereby your work is only just enough time for you to actually complete. There's no idea of overruns, there's no idea of going back to ask users, there's no idea of anything, right? It's just you've just got enough time, supposedly, for you to deliver your user feedback. And this also relates to the too little time constraint, whereby typically people know who are project managers. They know the engineering, they know how the software is going to go, and they allocate appropriate time or more time than required for that, but they don't necessarily know about the user experience, so they don't allocate enough time, or they expect that you can do it in a fraction of the time because users don't matter, they'll just have to deal with the code. And so that's the too little time constraint. These two things typically work together. The non-specialist time constraint is where you might have people who are non-specialist UXers, and therefore they're badly planning what must go next. And also there's the inadequately funded constraint, whereby there's not enough money to pay for participants, and so also there's probably not enough money to pay for resources, tools, people, other UXers to be able to get the work done, graphic designers, visual designers, etc., because it's seen as being something that is superfluous. It's not the main core of the work, which is obviously always for an engineer, software engineering. So remember that that you can be inadequately funded. There's also the presupposed outcome constraint, whereby really you're just there to tick box that it's been asked for, it's been expected that there'll be some user input, you know, user participation, user studies, but really, yeah, they're not really thinking that's a useful thing to be doing, and so therefore they're not thinking that they're going to have to change anything. What they're thinking is that that you're just going to do the tick boxing, that the users are going to pretend that everything is okay, or you're going to say that the user said everything's okay. So it's a presupposed outcome. They aren't thinking that they're going to have to go back to the drawing board and start to re-engineer the interfaces, which is obviously problematic. That's related to the due diligence constraint, whereby all they're doing is due diligence. All they're going to do is just say, right, tick the boxes. We're just looking at users because we're supposed to, because it's expected. There's also the implicit overrun constraint, where you're given so little time that you are going to overrun. And because you're going to overrun, it's going to be your fault, not the software engineers. And so you need to also think about what that means for your planning and how you're going to handle that. Are you going to ask for more time and then say, well, you asked and you weren't given it, so that's problematic. Finally, the unconstrained experiment. Nothing ever happened. You're never going to get one of these unless you're at an academic institution, and even then it's tricky. So here you can just do what you like. It's unconstrained. They really want to know everything. There's enough time, there's enough money, there's enough resources. Yeah, it's very unlikely that you're going to get that. Now, the things that you can do based on the amount of time and the commissioning constraint assumptions that you've got is still quite a lot. There's still something you can do. So I'm calling these things again run on a spectrum. They go from the very, very superficial to the much more tested. And so therefore you can say there's a flavour elicitation that you can't really say anything, but you can kind of ask a few people, work around a bit, talk to a few people and get some ideas so that you can write something up based on heuristics, based on your prior knowledge, based on the knowledge that these people have that you've asked. But it's really just a flavour. You're not saying anything definite. Then there's the ideas elicitation, whereby really it's about a set of ideas that could happen. You're not saying which one should or can, but you actually are saying that these are ideas that have come out of some of the, I don't know, focus groups, or that you've just run some, you know, informal discussions over the space of a week or two. You've got the informal elicitation, which we've seen before, the formal elicitation, which we've also seen before, and then you've got the laboratory elicitation, whereby everything is tightly controlled. Now, what you've got to realise is that the laboratory elicitation might seem to be a useful thing, but it's also it will give you a very tightly controlled piece of work. Just as we've said in the evaluation, part, then there's these idea of confounding variables. Confounding variables are the variables which you can't account for. So therefore, you create laboratory experiments to remove as many of those confounding variables as possible. But it's not ecologically valid. It's not in a free living situation, and so therefore it's not how people really behave, because they're in a laboratory. And the same is true for this. The laboratory elicitation, it's got some good points and it's also got some bad points. You will suffer from limitations of time. There won't be enough. Participants, you can't get the right ones. Very difficult to get them. Sometimes participants will tell you what they want you to hear. Sometimes participants will be negative, even though they're not really, the things that they're talking about aren't really that negative. So participants and their management is a tricky thing. Resources as well. Do you have enough UXs? Do you have enough graphic designers? Those are the things that can be difficult and tricky to also understand. And what's more, the available skills. So do we have the skills that allow us to collect data? So the instruments, can we run the instrumentation? And when I talk about instrumentation, I mean things like, do we have eye trackers? Do we have audio recorders? Do we have specialist software or specialist techniques that we're using that we need people who are specialists to work on? The data collection, do we have enough people to do the data collection, and how can that data collection work? And likewise, do we have the right people to do the kind of analysis that we want to do? Does it need to be non-parametric? Do we have statisticians who are able to design this? Are they able to give us a coherent plan and therefore give us the correct answers that we can work with? The one thing that I would definitely get you to think about is optimism. So we are software engineers, we're computer scientists, we build things, so we're optimistic. We always think, yes, we can build it, give us enough time and, you know, we can build anything. So we can build this piece of software, no worries. And that's a problem, because we always think that one, we're going to be able to do it, and two, we're going to be able to do it in a very short amount of time, because we're optimistic. But this isn't the case, and it certainly isn't the case that Brooks thought of when he wrote The Mythical Man Month. So Brooks was a project engineer and ran the IBM 360 project back in the 60s. And he's got lots and lots of experience in this kind of work. And so his book, The Mythical Man Month, is a key piece of text that, even though it's quite old now, actually there's still a lot of nuggets in there which are useful to understand. So the central point of The Mythical Man Month is that if you add more people, you'll get more work done. And the answer, that's not the case. Typically, if you add more people, production goes down because you have to take the people who are trained off of those tasks to start to train the people you're adding. And also the people you're adding, they're sitting there because not all tasks can be parallelized. If they're sitting there waiting for other tasks to actually happen, well, that's a tricky thing, especially for a piece of software that's a megalith or a piece of software that's not been correctly partitioned up with API calls. And that's why, again, I think that microservices architecture and DevOps allows you to do a better job of parallelization of tasks and therefore parallelization of people and resources. Another issue is the second system effect. So generally what we also talk about is that, or in our optimistic view, is that the first version, the minimum viable product, as we call it now, is going to be good. It's going to be usable, but then, and it's going to be minimal and easy to work with. But then we get a lot of feature requests. Then we have our own feature requests and we decide we want to add more and we want to add more and we want to add more and we want to add more. And suddenly you get a bloated piece of software that doesn't work properly. What we also have to think about is that Brooks talks about a thing called a throwaway project. And a throwaway project is something that you learn with. So actually the design that we've been talking about, the requirement solicitation, etc., is we would say the first thing you do is build a throwaway project, put it in front of people. People don't like it, throw it away, do the next one. Now, there's been some discussion about this because, you know, is this the case with Agile? And the reality is that I still think this is okay, because the reality is that for Agile, you get a minimum viable product, you test it, put it in front of people. People don't like it, you throw away what doesn't work and start on updating things that do work. It's not so version or release focused, and it's much more agile and fast, but it's still, you are still throwing core components away because they're not useful. So what I think you ought to take away from this is that, one, don't beat yourself up that the real world, exposure to the real world, is going to be tricky, messy, difficult, just everything you would expect. What's more, don't beat yourself up thinking that everybody is going to be on board, everything is going to be smooth, there's going to be enough resources and money and time, because there typically aren't. But also do take the idea that there are different levels of feedback that you can give, and those different levels are something that we know from the heuristics, we know from prior work, but we also can mush those up with some small user studies. As long as people know that that's what's happening, you're not getting a definitive answer. This is definitely, say, the flavour of what people are looking for, but it's difficult to say anything more definite than that. Then that's fine. That's exactly what we would be expecting. Finally, when you're trying to plan for these projects, realize that that more people won't help necessarily. In fact, they'll slow it for quite a long period of time, such that the overruns will be magnified. Only if you've got lots and lots of development time going off into the future is it useful to add more people, because that way the benefits of those people will start to add up over a period of time, and it's a longer period of time. What's more, also realise that while those benefits are coming along, if you haven't got a highly partitioned system, it's very tricky to make sure that everybody's doing optimal work in a system that is not very well parallelized, because people have to wait for others to finish. Okay, in that case, we will now move on to the next and final chapter of our course.